One. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Authority Smashing Hour with your hosts, Quinn Kim and Mr. 1001 Nights. Join us as we embark on a journey through radical news and politics, take callers, and get you ready to engage in the struggle against capitalism.
Hello, wage slaves, once again to the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist radio show on the internet. And we're supposed to have Eric today, but he can't make it for some personal reasons. And thus we have Buddha Jam. Welcome back,
Buddha. Hey, hey. Yeah, man, I wanted to save everybody from hearing you drone on for an hour, so I thought I'd jump in. But no, that's what you said in the email.
Great, man. Well, I'm glad you made it.
I'm confused. I don't understand why the old intro is still playing. I even checked it tonight. On our switchboard, it shows the new one as the starting intro. I don't know.
Do you want to play that again? I don't know. I think we have to maybe delete the
No, because you could set you could set any of the tracks that we have on our switchboard as the starting track, and the new one that I uploaded is set. It says if you go into the particular thing, it shows it as the startup track.
Right.
And like I said, I just checked it, and yet the old one still played. So maybe I will. I'll just delete the old one off the switchboard, so maybe won't have a problem. But again, I was looking forward to hearing it, and
I can play it right now. You want to hear it?
No.
Well, you made it. I'm sure you heard it. So, but anyway,
yeah, I've heard it, but I just thought it'd be cool to start the show out.
So, I have a sort of bad news here, which is sort of tied in with some good news. The bad news, and I don't know if this is final, but it looks like it's going to be final, is that Cindy Milstein, who was supposed to do the show with us, I just got her email like about 10, 20 minutes ago, that she feels intimidated because, the show, it's 1 hour and you got to talk about a lot of things. And she heard the show and she thought, well, we're so knowledgeable. We're talking about so many things. And that she talked to someone that told her that for every hour of show, you need 10 hours of preparation. And I mean, I'm going to answer. I'm going to send her an email and say, look, it's nothing like that. I don't devote 10 hours here to prepare for the show. I, as the main...
No, it's more like 12. Right?
Right, like 30 hours here. No, I mean, look, at most, 1 hour, sometimes, today was half an hour. I got home late. I prepared for about half an hour. It's not 10 hours. So I hope Cindy can actually change her mind. But the fact that we made that impression on her, I guess maybe means that we do sound knowledgeable, at least. we do sound prepared.
I'm blown away by that, actually. I mean, because I am someone who's always been very impressed with Cindy. She's a great public speaker. I think she gives she's very knowledgeable about anarchism, certainly. And like I said, I think last time I was on the show, one of the things that always struck me about her is her demeanor in dealing with people who are antagonistic, say to anarchism or, and she's always she's very good at kind of smoothing things out and yet still giving her opinion, which is a very strong opinion on anarchism. She doesn't waffle at all. I mean, she's very, she's a very strong woman, but she has a very good way, I think, of getting the points across about anarchism, bringing up relevant examples, I would love to have her on the show. And, like you said, I mean, someone tells you 10 hours of prepare time, obviously. I mean, I put in 15 hours, but, that's just me.
Right. I mean, just think about this. I mean, if I was preparing 10 hours every day for the show, this would be, more than a full-time job. I wouldn't even gain the 8-hour day. I thought the anarchists were supposed to respect the 8-hour day here, and it would be an 11-hour day just for the show.
Yeah.
No, but, it's...
I'm sure we definitely could put in more time than we do. Yeah,
it's true.
I can't imagine putting 8 hours time. Wow. Yeah, let's not do that.
Right. I mean, what I was gonna say is basically that you know, yeah, it would be nice if we use more time to prepare for the show. But as of now, most of us are not devoting all that much time. We talk about a few issues here and there, and so far, that seems to be enough to you know improve the show, and you know we're getting more and more listeners and so on. So that's a good sign. But you know, it's sad because we do really need a female voice. Particularly a female voice like hers.
Speaking of a female voice, I have someone in mind I felt like asking, but I don't know if this is appropriate, but maybe we shouldn't talk about it on the air, but what the hell? But the person I'm thinking of isn't an anarchist. Do you think that would be an issue? I mean, she's certainly a radical, but she's not an anarchist.
Who you talking about here?
Well, I'm trying to be mysterious about it, but it's
Nuclear
just an
Knight?
idea I had of. Yeah.
Oh yeah, I'm totally in favor of that. I mean, you know, if yeah, I mean, she. In fact, we agree with her on many issues, and I do know she's more of a trot than a libertarian socialist, but you know,
Right, right.
I do agree with her on many issues. So I no, if she wants, you know, we're desperate for female voices, so we you know we'll
Right.
accept anyone in the radical left. Now, if they do. Say certain things from a more you know Trotskyist perspective. I may counter it with my own ideas, you know, and that way
Well, I
people,
hope you would.
yeah. So
Yeah, I hope you
or
would.
your own ideas or whoever's on the show who doesn't agree. No, but I think that we have a lot of points in common. So
Right,
absolutely,
right.
I think that would be great to have her if she wants to. And you know, I repeat, you know, it's not 10 hours of preparation. I mean, come on, man, it's not even. An hour sometimes. So no. So yeah.
Yeah.
If she wants to, you know what? I'm gonna tell Cindy. I'm gonna ask her to please call in. To please call in and see how easy it is to talk, to discuss issues, to speak your mind.
Right.
You know, none of us here are nuclear physicists. You know, we're not discussing equations or anything like that. So you know.
Right.
So. But
Definitely.
other than that, I guess that we could maybe look at some of the news here. There's more evidence of the stuff the radicals were talking about years ago, and I think this is a pattern that very often we, after the fact, you know, we, you know, a few years after whatever, we start discovering a lot of the facts that the anti-war movement was talking about. So, I mean, right now, for example, this email showing Bin Laden was Bush talking point, not target. Millions of messages sent, but only a handful mention Al-Qaeda leader. You know, there's just so many of these little sort of factual, you know, pieces of evidence coming to the fore, showing that indeed, you know, all the propaganda that we were warning the public about back in 2003, back in 2004, even back in 2002, all those things. Are true, and back then we were called Marxists, we were called you know all kinds of things because we did not believe what the government was saying. So I mean, have
We
you
were called
observed?
anti-American.
Right, you are and you hate this country because you're not. I mean, it's just amazing that so many years after. I mean, this is a pattern as well. I mean, don't you observe that pattern that time after time, radical
I
analysis.
have observed a pattern that time after time, I'm right.
Right.
It's amazing. You've noticed that too?
You're always right, man, except when you're wrong. But no, I mean, but this
Yeah,
is,
all right.
I mean, don't you
So
think that the public would have sort of seen this pattern of getting it right for so many, you know, years if the radical analysis were a little bit more exposed, more disseminated?
Oh, certainly. I mean, obviously, that's part of the propaganda model. And one of the things I mentioned in that last video I did, well, I didn't mention, it's actually Richard Wolff, an economist, and he points out that American workers work 20% more than their European counterparts, were exhausted. You know, and that's one of the things I encounter a lot with people I work with is, you know, I mean, you got to figure they're working all these hours, they're commuting 2 to 4 hours a day. They get home, they have children to take care of, spouses to take care of, you know, and then, you know, and then people wonder, why don't you know everything that's going on? You know, like, you know, people who are like us who have the opportunity to look into these matters, to study, you know, not very often you get this smug reply from radicals that, like, the rest of the people are just stupid, as if it's a problem of intelligence. The fact is, these facts that we're talking about, like regarding the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, yeah, they're out there, but they're not easily accessible. You know, when that you know wage slave gets home, takes care of the kids, takes care of the spouse, turns on the boob tube, he's not likely to come across some radical analysis of the war in Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan. You know, these things are out there, but it takes work to find them. It takes opportunity, and that's something we've had the opportunity to kind of study these matters.
It's also worth noting that the ideological managers, I also like to call them wage slaves, because they are working for the bosses. They're getting paid very often better than other workers, but they're paid to generate all this propaganda, and so they work night and day to indoctrinate the masses and to maintain the order that we live in. And I know go ahead.
And they actually do get, you know, the 8 hours probably to kind of do all the research and stuff to prepare for the show. Like, I was just on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart, you know, and you're in and out there to actually watch the show be filmed. It's about an hour, you know, and half of that is like, you know, you're just getting warmed up by some, you know, junky comic. But, you know, it's really fast, but all the little clips and stuff that they have, if you ever watch the show, they're already prepared by that time. So I can imagine that's a full, like, you know, that's someone's full-time job to prepare all these news clips and do all the research that goes behind whatever Jon Stewart happens to say. You know, and that's the benefit that the mainstream media gets, is these are real jobs where people can put that kind of energy and, you know, time into it. Whereas you and I, we certainly don't have that kind
right.
of time.
We're
trying to survive in this capitalist system.
It's the resources. I mean, in fact, that's part of the reason, you know, in my answer to, I think you got an email from this student in, I think it was New York, who was studying journalism. And I mentioned a few days back of how he was asking all these questions about journalism. And I said that we're not, I mean, even though we're very critical of the corporate media, since they have all the resources, they can actually afford to send journalists to places and do some investigative journalism. And that if they collapse, you know, even though, you know, obviously they put out a lot of propaganda and stuff, that we don't have anything to substitute that with. Because we the economic system is so skewed. We have so little capital to engage in investigative journalism that you know, even though, yes, we can do some things at the local level, we can do, you know, we can open a blog, we can do the kind of projects we do, but it's still not, we can't replace that. And that has to do with the skewed economic system we live in. So we go back to the economic imperatives that our society is based on.
Right. And I have so little capital that all my letters are lowercase. So, you know,
hey, man, I should memorize that one. That's a good one. I may actually say something here, which I already said yesterday, but that I was actually in a struggle this last few days, because I was editing the Wikipedia article on the police, you know, and oh boy, that article is guarded like Fort Knox. I was mentioning that yesterday. And I had like four or five guys, you know, they just wouldn't let me change it, because I added the word hierarchical to order. They said, you know, they maintain order, right? And I said, no, they maintain a hierarchical order. And oh boy, like I thought my arguments were pretty strong. I mean, like they really had nothing but straw man, and they called me a Marxist, and I was trying to appear at, and I, you know, quoted the dictionary definition of order in the sense of what the police do, which is to make people obey authority. That's basically what order amounts to in that context, and so on. So I was quoting the dictionary, I was doing all these things, but still, I mean, I couldn't get across. I mean, these guys were like, calling me a Marxist. They telling me to drop Das Kapital, Das Kapital. It says, you know, stop reading Das Kapital. I mean, stuff like that. Just because I put that word in, and I was trying to argue for that. It's just incredible that you have people like that who just you know, who to devote, you know, so much of their energy. And of course, the other guy is how the world works. I mean, yesterday we were talking about this new video called, you know, it's from the person who did Story of Stuff. There's a new one on Cap and Trade. And of course, How the World Works had to make a rebuttal, you know, refuting this new Cap and Trade video. I mean, it's just people like this, you know, it really, I mean, they're part of the reason why we're doing this show, don't you think?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. you know, to kind of counter some of that. You know, I know, like, some of my videos, people, I get, like, the guy Variablast, who's obviously, you know, like, doesn't know a whole lot about politics. And someone, you know, people comment, like, why would you spend so much time picking on someone like this? But it's not him as a person, but it's the arguments. There's, you know, these mainstream arguments, you kind of hear repeated over and over, you know, ad infinitum, and they're so repugnant that I think it's important to, like, take time sometimes to, you know, like, someone, for instance, an anti-war argument, or a war, an argument for the war, I don't know how to put it, but, you know, people would say, well, you know, we're in Iraq for the oil, and then the counter to that would be, well, if we're there for the oil, how come our gas is so expensive? You know? I mean, it's a really stupid argument. But,
as if the corporations, you know, were actually doing that for them. Oh, yeah, the corporations are trying to get you.
Right. Yeah.
So you and the corporations are a big happy family, and they're just trying to get you cheap gas. I mean, it's just...
yeah, but, you know, as easy as that is to argue out of, there are people who, like, that style, you know, like, oh, yeah, that's true. You know what I mean? Like, so... You know, I think it's important to provide kind of, I've always seen something that I do is, like, to try to provide arguments for people or to show them the weaknesses of arguments that they're going to hear, you know, regarding global warming or, you know, wage slavery or whatever. So it's usually not about the person, but it's about, you know, the kind of these arguments that we're going to be confronted with, you know, as radicals and activists. You often get, you know, well, what about this? You know, it's a gotcha mentality. Like, oh, but, you know, like, who's going to build the roads? You know, that's the one you always get to anarchists, right? Who's going to build the roads? Like, oh, we hadn't thought of that. Sorry. Okay, we'll go back to the drawing board.
Right. I mean, and to give you an example from this particular debate that I was having is that they equated order with hierarchy. that's so pervasive, like order, and of course the word order has many meanings as well in the dictionary, like over 50 meanings, but you know, and so you have, like, I've noticed this pattern. I don't know if you've noticed it when you debate people and you know, you both sort of argue the facts and you actually try to do it in a civilized manner, like you try to not get hysterical right away, not scream at each other, but then but then at the very end of it, you basically run into this sort of pattern in which each side just says the same thing over and over again, and then you run into a wall and you realize you're running into a belief, you know, like, for example, you're saying, you know, the United States is good, you know, we go around the world, we're trying to help people, and so that's the belief, right? So you may actually argue, well, look at what happened in this country, look at what happened there, look at this this data about what happened there, you present all this data, but at the end, since all your belief system is based on this, you know, the notion that, say, the United States is good or whatnot, then you run into a wall. And that's where the constant sort of, you know, grinding of the ideological system must take place. We must, you know, day by day do what, say, Democracy Now does, which is, you know, try to challenge some of the, you know, daily factual propaganda from the corporate media.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that helps, but I also think sometimes, I mean, in my own personal experience, when you run into that wall where you know, you're just kind of going over the same stuff, it's really important at that point, I think, to start asking questions, you know, and pulling an old Socrates on them. You know, like, well, you believe this, right? You believe this. Aha, you're an anarchist. No. But really, though, asking questions to kind of get at the underlying assumptions, you know, that are there, and then try to maybe deal with those as best you can, you know, to try to diffuse it. Because if you're just going to bat someone over the head with facts and figures that they're not familiar with, like I just saw Bill Maher was interviewing some guy, and he brings up some, you know, study, right? And it was countervailing to whoever the guest was, to what the guy believed. He goes, what about this study? Well, you know, you can bring up a study. It doesn't mean I'm familiar with it. You know what I mean? Just because you tell me there's a study doesn't mean I should change my views, you know? It's like, the way Bill Maher was putting it, though, is like, I know about a study you don't know about, therefore everything you know is wrong. I mean, you know, that's how I think we often come across to people, because we know a lot of things that are going on. Like, you know, you're talking about stuff with Iraq, the anti-war stuff that's, you know, been documented, and, you know, like the Downing Street memo and all these things, a lot of people aren't familiar with. And just batting people over the head with them, you know, it's just like what Bill Maher did. Maybe the study he's talking about is real and it's true and it's the most awesome study ever done. I'm not, you know, it's irrelevant. But the fact is, like, that's how we come across, like, you know, there's a study done at Princeton that says anarchism is the coolest thing ever. And, you know, and people aren't familiar with that study. So, you know, we have to find out what people are, you know, and what they know, and come at them from a, you know, from at that point, you know, and not just kind of beat them over the head with how smart we are and how politically knowledgeable we are.
Right. You know? And also, I guess we know we live in a context where, as you were mentioning, that economist Rick Wolf was talking about how American workers work more than ever. So, I mean, if you're working so many hours a day in a job that you probably don't enjoy very much, not getting paid all that much, and you know, what are you going to do in your free time? You know, are you going to be talking about unpleasant things like politics or whatever? No, you want to take a break, you know, watch the game, drink a beer, maybe go meet a girl or whatever. I mean, you know, it doesn't sound unreasonable. But then again, you know, if you and, you know, what kind of ideas do you have about our political system and about foreign policy? Well, you know, you'll look at a little bit at the news and you'll get an overall idea of what the sort of feel is of what it's going on. And obviously, unless you know the details, you're going to be left with the assumptions, the mainstream assumptions. So.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, and I think that's one of the biggest things we do as radicals, or we can do, is not to, I don't think I ever really try to convert anyone to become an anarchist or even a radical. You know, people I work with on a daily basis, you know, like something will come up like healthcare, you know, and I can share some facts with them, went in the direction to look at some more information, to consider like some of the assumptions they have about, say, universal health care, or even bring up a fact like, but did you know that we spend more per capita than any country in the world, yet like a third of the population doesn't have access to health care? Or, you know, any of the numerous facts you can bring up, ideas, questioning their assumptions about our health care system, that it's the greatest. And you say, well, yeah, it's the greatest if you're Bill Gates. Is it the greatest for you? Like, I had a coworker, foreman, that I worked for, great guy, and he was telling me, you know, this is a guy who, in a lot of respects, you would be part of the Tea protester people. You know, like, he's a right wing kind of guy, conservative, in that kind of Rush Limbaugh sense, and you know, he has all these fears about universal health care, and yet he said, you know. But the thing is, it's always talking about how you have to wait for these tests and stuff in this socialized healthcare. He goes, but I'll tell you, as carpenters, we have one of the best, you know, insurance programs, I guess, in the New York City area. That's what I've been told, at least. And he said he had to wait like 6 weeks for a really important test on his heart. You know, he said it's 6 weeks. This is something that, you know, his cardiologist said he needed, and, you know, yet it still had to go through all these different things. And he's like, you know, that could have meant my life. And that's in one of the best, you know, insurance programs there is, and, you know, the best healthcare, you know, as far as he thinks, best healthcare systems. And he thinks, hey, you know, how much worse could it be? You know, really? You know, so you get people thinking like that, and you know, And I don't know where he went with that, but it was interesting to see his thought process develop. And then he goes off. And, you know, that's it's something I think we try to do is plant seeds to get people to think a little deeper about things. And a little deeper may not be as deep as you want them to think about it, you know? So, you know, talking about wage slavery, you might not get them to the point where they want to abolish the wage system, but they might begin to see the radical inequalities between, you know, the CEOs and the workers and different things. So, you know, it's fundamental, I think, to get to where people are and then to let the discussion flow from there in a natural way without just trying to be like, you know, I'm going to teach you everything you need to know about the world.
I think that one of the valuable things that Barry Pateman said in the talk that you attended and I listened to on YouTube was that he said...
No, I didn't get to attend.
Oh, you didn't attend?
Yeah,
that?
I didn't get...
Oh, okay. Then
no,
I'm mistaken about that. But anyway, yeah. He said that he was hoping that, you know, if we ever achieve something like anarchism, that people would cease to be activists, would cease to be anarchists, because they would just... And you know, the environment, you know, that they're, you know, that they, you know, a free environment that would not require any anarchist going against the sort of, you know, paradigm we have now. So,
right.
You know, but once again, if, you know, if a society like that would require an educated working class, you know, looking at the working class now, you know, it's sort of like, you know, there's a lot of, you know, if you talk to people, it's just that, you know, their concerns, what they're worried about, what they think about, is very often not at all, you know, having to do with anything that we talk about here. You know, they worry about their immediate financial troubles. Maybe they worry about astrology, going out, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it's just something that's why a lot of people thinking, look, is it possible to have an educated working class? And I don't think that's impossible. I mean, I honestly think that there's so many things that are unnatural right now that people pursue with such passion just because the environment has pushed them in that direction that, you know, I just don't
think.
Well,
you know, one of the interesting things Chomsky, I've heard point out, is, you know, because very often you get this, well, the masses are just stupid, you know, and blah, you know, whatever. And Chomsky's pointed out numerous times, if you listen to, like, sports radio, and I have a coworker who listens to that, you know, you get these guys, they're just average working people, and they call in, and, you know, they've got detailed analysis, and they understand the history of the team, and, I mean... You can, yeah, maybe it's irrelevant, it's superficial, whatever, but it's a real use of their intelligence, and, you know, they've compiled these facts and figures, and, you know, you get these people who, they know what the 1927 Yankees did, and the third game, and, you know, that's using intelligence, you know, and they're, you know, okay, they don't use it for politics, doesn't mean they're stupid, you know, but most people feel so disenfranchised, like they have nothing to... You know, no input in the political system whatsoever, and so what do? They find another outlet for their intelligence. You know, doesn't mean that they're just stupid. You know, they find another outlet where they're making rational, intelligent arguments. You know, something that they're passionate about, something maybe they feel they have some input in, and you know, the idea that the masses are not smart. Again, I always try to assess with people. It's not a matter of intelligence, it's a matter of opportunity. You know, some of us have been blessed in a way or, you know, had the opportunity to study these things. It's not because we're smarter, you know? I mean, come on. It's not an intelligence thing. It's
okay.
Just, you know.
Okay, folks, we're approaching half an hour, so we're going to go to a break here, play a little song, and when we come back, we'll take your calls and also go through some news items. And the guest call-in number is 646-716-8106. Once again, 646-716-8106. So I guess we can play Bob Marley. Is that cool with you?
I love Bob Marley.
Little Bob Marley. Okay, Burning and Looting.
woke up in a curfew. Oh God, I was a prisoner too. Yeah, could not recognize the faces standing over me. They were all dressed in uniform of brutality. Hey, how many rivers do we have to cross before we can talk to the boss?
Burning and a Luton, and we're back on the Authority Smashing Hour, your daily anarchist show on the internet with your host Buddha Jam and Mr. 1001 Nights. And we're taking some calls, folks. 646-716-8106.
Hey, call in. You don't.
What's
yeah,
that?
Call in. You don't. I was just saying, you know, call in. You don't have to have a question. Maybe you have some insight. You want to tell us about an action going on. Whatever is on your mind, you know, you can ask a question in the chat room. You know, we welcome it.
And I want to remind people that we're going to have Paul Street here on Friday. Paul Street is a great writer who's written about a lot about Obama from a libertarian socialist perspective. Very sharp analysis, very sharp thinker. But we have a caller on the line.
I cut myself on some of that.
And you what, yourself?
I cut myself on some of that sharp analysis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the pages were pretty sharp as well, right?
Yeah.
All right, so we have a caller. What's your name? Hello?
Hello. Hey, how's it going?
Pretty
hey,
good.
Hey, welcome.
Hey, this is Mike. I called in like a bunch of times before.
Hey.
Cool. Hey, Mike.
How you doing?
Mike, you're here in New York, right?
I am, sir. Yes.
917. Cool, I can see the area code.
Yeah, I, you know, my phone is literally about to die, so I might get cut off here, but I heard a little bit of your conversation before, and I was reading a really interesting book the other day by Eric Frum called The Art of Being, and in it he mentions what you were talking about just in briefly. He talks about how, in the book he talks about man's relation to other men, and as people are treated as commodities in this economic system, you really what else can you expect that people would talk about, you know, if it's not going to be things that commodities would talk about if they could speak? So let's say, like, gold had the ability to speak. Gold would talk about the price at which it was selling, the price at which people were buying it, you know, expressing its disappointment when it didn't get sold at the right price. You know, it would say, how much am I being sold in relation to this other commodity? So, you know, when you treat people like that, like, what else can people really talk about? But that's the only thing I just wanted to say. It's a pretty
Mike, do you think we should be fighting for the rights of gold to, you know, free it from the oppression of being commodified?
The rights of gold?
I'm just joking around. I'm just joking.
I have a big gold bar tattooed to my arm, actually. It's like...
Oh, that's cool. And that was Eric Fromm?
Eric Fromm, yeah, The Art of Being.
Okay, very cool, very cool. Appreciate you calling in, bro. You know, get in touch with me, man. You know, we're here in New York, so, I mean, there's lots of stuff going on. So,
For sure. I mean to do that, so.
Yeah.
So, all right, guys, take it easy.
Thanks a lot for the call, Mike.
Take it easy.
Actually, I don't know if you're aware that there's a book called "To Have or to Be" by Eric Fromm as well. I think it's one of the last he wrote, in which he basically said that we have two modes of being. I mean, two modes of existence: the having mode and the being mode, and we are all somewhere in between, obviously. And that someone who's, he said, someone who's on the being mode the whole time, he's like a saint, you know. And someone who's on the having mode the whole time, that person is like crazy, you know. Yeah, obviously our society tends toward the having mode, where like where, you know, everything is having,
Well, rather. So much of our status, in this society is based on what you have, do you have the right clothes? Do you have the right house? Do you have the right books? Do you have, I mean, it's really so much is based on possessions. It's not surprising that we spend a lot of time in the have mode, right? I mean, a very common question I get asked by other men in my, age range is, what toys do you have? And that's supposed to imply like boats and, jet skis and all these toy, and then we gauge how, I guess, how successful we are by how many toys each of us has, And I started thinking about that and the reality. I mean, on the superficial level, it's about the possessions you have. But the reality is, what's underlying that is how much debt are you in, Because no matter how much money someone makes in the society, like all that means is that you will take on a greater burden of debt, right? So, I could have a friend who's making $30,000 a year, and he might be in, $60,000 worth of debt. But my friend making $120,000 a year is going to be in like $500,000 worth of debt. Like he's really making it because he's got a huge debt. I mean, it's just insane. And I know people who make a bucket load of money. I mean, they're high paid wage slaves, right? And yet, all that means is they've taken on an even more enormous amount of debt.
And in
And it's
fact,
just,
debt was probably one of the most important factors in the current economic crisis, together with the liberalization of finance since the 1970s. So
Well,
work.
Richard Wolff points out in that video I just did. I have a clip of him, and he's talking about it. During the Great Depression, he points out that the average American's debt was about 20% of their annual income. He said during this, the Great Depression 2.0 that we're all living in, the average debt of an American right now is 120% of their annual income. That's amazing, and that's exactly what I was talking about. If you made 60, grand a year, you've got $120,000 in debt. If you made $250,000 a year, you have $500,000 in debt. I mean, that's basically, well, I suck at math, obviously, because I messed that up,
So we
but
have a
you
caller
get
on
the
the
picture.
line. Right, we have a caller on the line. Invader Zeno.
Invader Zeno.
Hello? Are you there, Invader
Hello?
Zeno?
Are you there, Invader Zeno?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, we're getting a little,
Yeah, we get a little,
Yeah, I turned off the other speaker.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Okay, how about now?
Wait a second. Yeah, we were getting echo there when I opened his mic. So, if you want Invader Zeno, just we'll wait about a minute, and then I'll open your mic again to make sure we don't have this problem. So anyway, so continuing on the subject of debt, are you there, David?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. One of the problems that here in California, a lot of students are protesting about is the rise in UC tuition. 32% starting next year, and those UC regions, I mean, they're the biggest assholes in the world. But yeah, and as you know, you were sending me this article, something that actually also I announced yesterday, that there was at San Francisco State University, there was a protest today, pretty much all day, protesting these hikes in tuition, and.
Well, not just a protest. Let's be clear here. It's not just protests. They actually occupied the I think it's the office building.
Right,
calling.
Right. Yeah. It's an occupation. Yeah, so, they're trying to occupy
it. Yeah, it's an occupation. So, you know, I mean, I think it's awesome. It's, you know, those students taking matters into their own hands. And we've got to applaud that. And we've got to keep pressure on the police, because the police will definitely, the police and the regents, if nobody's paying attention. These are instances. We've had this here in New York and at New School and various other occupations. It's very important for us who aren't necessarily directly involved to let people know about what's going on, to keep a presence, to maintain the pressure on the authorities to where they don't just go and expel these people. They don't go and just throw them into jail. So even though we're on the sidelines in this thing, it's something we can still be a part of in showing solidarity. You know, and sharing this with people on our Facebook pages or whatever it is, getting the word out about it and keeping the pressure so that the police don't just go in there and manhandle these people. So, right. You know, it's really cool. It's always, to me, it's always encouraging when you see occupations. I mean, that's, I think Chomsky's pointed out, you know, an occupation, you know, a sit down strike or an occupation, I mean, the next step is taking it over, you know.
Well, someone said.
These are spaces, you know. We occupy them and go, wow, it's ours.
So it really scares them because it's one step away from taking over the factory. And as someone said, occupy the factories, not other countries. You know, don't, you know. So certain occupations are good, others are not good. You know, so right.
Is that true?
Well, yeah, the word occupation has different meanings, but I just opened the mic of Invader Zeno and I seem to get that echo again. So let me try one more time. Let me try one more time. See, Invader Zeno,
you there?
Yeah,
we're still getting a major echo on you.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. I'm sorry.
So yeah, so we can't. Yeah, if you call in some other phone, I hope it's not a prank or anything like that, because we have had.
No, I don't think it's a prank. I don't think it's a prank. I think he just genuinely. I mean, that happens. If someone in the chat room has any ideas of why he's getting that, I think he's in the chat room. I'm not sure. Invaders, you know, yeah, he's in the chat room. So if anybody in the chat room has any ideas of what he could do to. Maybe eliminate that echo. That'd be great.
Oh yeah, he is.
Certainly, like, take his call.
He can ask the question on the chat room. We'll be glad to answer any questions.
Right, right. Yeah, you can ask your question in there. Sorry about that, Invaders. You know, it's Mr. 1001 Nights runs a tight ship when it comes to audio. He will not stand for any echo.
Well, not that kind of amount of echo, but. So anyway,
even Chomsky doesn't get on sometimes because he has his audio connection's too bad. So well, you know, he's very authoritarian when, you know, it suits him.
Right. Well,
he's just stalling on the audio. That's what Chomsky is just saying. He's stalling on the audio.
He's a microphone dictator.
Well, Invader Zeno's question is about anti-politics. So yeah, I'd love to ask your question. I'm sorry we couldn't get the thing out, but if you can ask it in the chat room, that'd be awesome, please. I mean, I we're certainly seeing the mood of anti-politics going on. You know, that's what's behind a lot of these Tea Party things. He mentioned the punk patriot who has the Fuck Chomsky video that I mentioned last time I was on. I mean, the mood of anti-politics is strong. It's scary for so many reasons, you know. I think, you know, it's kind of embodied by, like, someone like Ron Paul, who, like, you know, they, you know, blame everything on the government, right? And you hide the real source of power in this country, you know, the corporate behemoths that are, you know, ruining our ecosystem. I mean, there was a story in the New York Times today, 20%, I think they said, of our nation's drinking water is, like, contaminated.
Right.
It's just insane when you think about it. I mean, you know, and yet so much of the emphasis is on the dumb government. You know, the government just can't get it right. And this sentiment of anti-politics is something that Chomsky certainly talked about a lot. It makes a lot of sense from a propaganda point of view. Is, you know, you want, people are going to be angry. You know that. As a ruling class, you know they're going to be upset. They're getting screwed over. Their wages have been stagnant for the last 30 years. They've incurred an enormous amount of debt. They're getting thrown out of their homes. Tent cities are popping up. They're unemployed. So who are you going to blame? You're not going to blame the people who are really fucking everything up. You're going to blame the government. You know? Why? Well, two reasons. One, it takes the heat off of you. Second, because the government has a super major flaw. It's, you know, potentially influential by us, the people. Now, you know, I'm not just speaking about voting. There's a lot of other ways we can influence and push the government in ways that we want it to act. You know, public pressure. That's Jonathan mentioned the single payer, coalition. I think it's the Coalition to End Private Insurance. Mm-hmm. But, there's a lot of different things, grassroots actions. You know, that's the civil rights movement. That's the labor movement. That's the suffragist movement or the abolitionist movement. You know, these things are, they didn't care. Like Gandhi, I was just at the talk by Norman Finkelstein. He said, you know, people would say, Gandhi, what do you think, the British are going to do? He'd say, I don't care what the British are going to do. You know, we're going to do what we're going to do. And if we do it right, the British will have to do what we want them to do. And that's what we have to think. Like, you know, if we get our shit together, you know, we can run this thing. We are the majority. So, wondering about what the ruling class is going to do, who cares?
Well, for our day in history, I guess we could say that today...
Oh, I had a good one.
Many years right. ago, in 1842, which would make it, how many years? 100 and, I'm bad at math, 100 and, anyway, in 1842, sorry for my bad math, 1842 today, the 9th of December, Peter Kropotkin was born, the anarchist communist who wrote Mutual Aid and Memoirs of a Revolutionist. He was born, and... I suggest anyone who's interested in anarchism to read his books and actually in the anarchist FAQ at infoshop.org, there was a lot of quotes and a lot of texts from his books. So that's one.
I just wanted to is Kropotkin actually wrote the definition of anarchy in the 11th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Did you know that?
I don't think
I've ever read it.
And it was good. It was really good. I think I read it a long time ago.
Oh, you're awesome. I didn't know that. Yeah, I just learned that. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Go Encyclopedia Britannica. I don't know what their current definition of anarchy reads like, but I'm guessing it's not as well written as Kropotkin's.
Also, in 1905, this day, Dalton Trumbo, the person who wrote Johnny Got His Gun, I don't know if you heard about that book. It's actually, I have also the movie that was made after the book. It's about war, First World War, and the horrors of war.
Yeah, isn't that the old Metallica video one, where the guy's just like a little corpse? Like, he's just a little body, like, you can't.
Right, it's a story about, you know, he's all indoctrinated about, you know, the jingoistic propaganda, gotta serve your country, you know, gotta gotta fight the war, and you know, he's got this girl that likes him a lot, and he tells her, look, I have to leave, I have to serve my country, and of course, you know, First World War was one of the most dumb wars in history, so he goes, fights this war, and he gets, you know, loses, you know, his face, his limbs. He basically is just a chunk of meat, you know. But he can feel the something on his skin, right? And he learned Morse, and so he was making a movement with his finger all along, but the nurse didn't know what it was, you know. And at the end, he tells them, look, why don't you put me out? Take me to the circus and let everyone look at me and see that this is what war is all about. And And toward the end, of course, they don't want to do it, so he gets really angry, and he starts tapping his finger with, you know, Morse saying over and over, kill me, kill me, kill me. And that's the end of the movie. And the nurse at the end, I think she either she kills him or tries to kill him and doesn't succeed, or they stop her. Or, I forget. It has a sad ending, so it's a pretty gruesome book, which in fact was banned during Second World War. It was banned because obviously it's not the kind of book you want to have around when you're fighting a war. So,
right. Go back to Invader Zeno. I'm sorry, I didn't notice that his question. He finally got put his question in there. And he's basically asking, does anti-politics bleed into anarchist thought? Do you think that anti-politics bleeds into anarchist thought, Mr. 1001 Nights?
The same way maybe a banana peel may, you know, it's maybe accidentally, but not, I don't think that's a natural path. No, I think a more natural path is getting involved in politics and questioning things in an interested manner. So I don't think so. Now, it is certainly true that a lot of people who are in the realm of anti-politics, they call themselves sort of free market anarchists and so on. But I don't think so. What do you think, Buddha Jim?
You know, I was thinking, to a certain degree, I think it does. I think especially to people who are new to anarchist thought, who maybe, like you said, not even necessarily free market anarchists, but people who, you know, there's this common idea you often hear that anarchism is just anti-government. And people, like, you know, they've been indoctrinated to think the government just fucks everything up. And then they learn about there's this philosophy out there that's anti-government. And so, we're talking about two different things, essentially, I think. On one hand, you're talking about people who maybe may or may not be familiar with anarchist history and thought, but yet self-identify as anarchists. And certainly, I think within that element, there is an element of anti-politics. But I think if you look deeper and become, you know, a radical, someone who, you know, looks at the roots of things and become radical about it, I think you know, anarchism takes you into a very political position. And that's, you know, dealing with the politics that we have now, understanding the politics that we envision, but realizing that if we want to get there, there are short-term changes that need to be made. You know, there's baby steps that need to be made to get there. You know, so while maybe, you know, I want to abolish the wage system, that doesn't mean I'm against the minimum wage, you know, which helps a lot of people. You know, it could be a lot better. And there's a lot of other things that are reform. You know, it's reform versus revolution. Yeah, there's not a dichotomy there. It's not even a constant question. I mean, any real revolutionary, you look back at the old anarchists. I mean, they're fighting for the 8-hour workday. They're fighting for things that were reformist. You know, and as Chomsky's pointed out, you push reform to the limit because that's where people are. You know, there's a consensus right now on health care. Well, you go to that. There's a consensus right now on the question of Palestine. You know, do we need to keep funding Israel? A lot of people will say no. So, you know, you defund Israel. Does that mean you're against a Palestinian state? No. You know, you push these things at where the consensus is. You don't give up on your principles, and you fight for the reforms that we can win now. You know, so I think a real anarchist is very involved in politics at a level that, you know, where he or she is passionate about.
So we have two more interesting facts of history here. Talking about radicals, this day in 1953, General Electric, in the United States, General Electric announces that all communist employees will be fired. Oh, man. So, yeah, you better remember that. U.S. black Philadelphia journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal is arrested and charged with the killing of a Philadelphia policeman. And as you guys know, he's still in jail on death row. So, I want to see if Invader Zeno is... Hello, Invader Zeno?
Hello, Invader Zeno?
No, that's not working. All right, I'm sorry, Invader Zeno. We just can't take your call.
Sorry, brother.
Hopefully next time we can get a good connection here.
GNU pointed out that there's a third one besides Reform and Revolution, and that is Replacement. And he's certainly correct. Yeah, and that's part of what prefigurative politics is about, is replacing the institutions that we have so many problems with. We want to create the institutions and the organizations that we want to see. The IWW slogan is to create the new society and shell the old. It's to replace it, you know. So certainly that's always the aim, you know, but we're not there, you know. Like another day in history, 1905, today in 1905, was a major loss for the Soviet workers in Russia. You know, think about that. I mean, the revolution's success was more than a decade away, you know, and yet, we tend to think of history as like these things that, you know, all of a sudden the Spanish Revolution just happened or the Russian Revolution just happened. No, there are a lot of huge failures building up to these things, you know. It takes a lot of work, a lot of patience. Yeah.
We were talking about some of the anarchist struggles against the Bolsheviks, and I suggest anyone who's interested in that period of time to read up on Kronstadt, what happened there when a lot of anarchists were slaughtered.
I always have to bring up Kronstadt.
And, you know, Machno, there is a rich history there, and I keep, you know, saying this, but I think the Anarchist FAQ is a good introduction to a lot of this history and a lot of this heritage that we should keep alive, because that's, that's the sort of background that we can use to learn about how to better push forward a lot of these ideas. So,
right.
Well, I guess we're getting pretty close. We have about 3 minutes before the end of the show, so...
Did you ever get a chance to play my 2-minute little thing on Finkelstein and his talk that I
no.
have?
We still have time. So what's it called?
It's Finkelstein on the Gandhian strategy.
Okay, well let's play it. All right.
Great.
People often say, if the Palestinians only had a Gandhi, the problem with people who make that kind of claim if they have not a clue what Gandhi actually wrote on these subjects. Gandhi was very clear on the fact, as he put it, that there are certain kinds of violence when, if they're resorted to against an overwhelming force, in his view, they're not violence. So, for example, he gave the example he gave the cases of a woman who resists a rapist with slaps and bites. Or he gave the example of the Polish in 1939, the Polish trying to resist the Nazi invasion of Poland. And in both cases, Gandhi said, whether it's a woman resorting to slaps and bites in order to fend
90 seconds,
or if the Poles in 1939 resisting this overwhelming force, the Wehrmacht and the Luftwaffe, with the pitiful Polish army, and I see a Polish friend in the background of my former students, don't be offended. he said in both of those cases, in his view, it wasn't violence, but the woman. When the woman was
right,
or the Polish army in the face of the Nazi invasion. He said because the quote-unquote violence is just purely symbolic. And he said all it really is to kind of fill up in order to give you the courage to die with dignity. And anybody who compares the situations, it doesn't seem to me that the Hamas rocket fire, which I'll return in a few moments, the Hamas rocket fire fit within the category. People often say, if the Palestinians own...
We cut a little short, but I think he...
10 seconds.
Really nails it there on, you know, when people bring up violence, in particular, you know, in relation to the Palestinians, they should just lay there and die. You know, you have to think of it in regards to the different forces of power that at work, you know? I mean, the Palestinians, you know, you're talking about a mouse fighting a 10,000-pound gorilla. So
I think the show is on but not streaming, so we're by the end of the show. So anyway, I guess no one's listening. So, but yeah, actually that was a pretty good show. I guess if we had planned that Finkelstein clip a little earlier. I guess I forgot about it. Oh, it's okay. Well, the thing is that we were doing the show without knowing that Eric wouldn't be here till the last minute. So. That's actually okay. Very, very good for you know, an improvised show like that. I think it worked out pretty good.
Yeah.
So.
So I'm gonna contact Nuclear Knight, you know, and see. I think she'd be